This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. When Maria Bello attended Villanova University, she planned on becoming a lawyer who specialized in women's rights. Those plans were derailed after taking an acting class, and she's gone on to have a long and really interesting career in film, TV, and theater. She won acclaim for her performances Natalie Belisario in The Cooler and Edie Stahl in The History of Violence. But while she's not an attorney, Maria Bello has been an advocate for women around the world. She co-founded We Advance after the 2010 Haiti earthquake to empower women to rebuild their lives and rebuild their country. Maria Bello is in Philadelphia to receive the Myra Bradwell Award from the Women's Law Project, where she interned a number of years ago when she was just 19 years old. Well, we invited Maria Bello to join us today in Radio Times to talk about her work in Haiti, talk about her acting and growing up in Norristown outside of Philadelphia. And Maria Bello, a great pleasure. Congratulations. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
So how did you end up answering phones at the Women's Law Project?
I was studying peace and justice education at Villanova, and it was during the time when we were really on the fence with Roe v. Wade. It was a very scary time for for women and for women's rights. I found out about the Women's Law Project, and I applied for an internship. I filled out a piece of paper, and it said, "Why do you want to do this?" And I said, I believe that my life, I'm supposed to be to service in, for service to women in some way. So Dabney Miller, who hired me, Dabney Miller, who hired me, actually still has that resume and showed it to me. And it was interesting to see what I wrote then and what my life has become, because I think that it put me on the trajectory, certainly inspired my life and shaped my life, what was to become my life as an advocate for women.
Were you surprised what people would tell an unnamed intern on a telephone?
Oh, I was very, very surprised. You know, my job and the telephone counselors even there now today are to listen to the women, which is a big deal. And that's what we do in Haiti, too. We believe in listening to women and hearing their stories and their needs. And that's what the Women's Law Project does. So as a phone counselor, I would take calls with a woman who had just been horribly beaten with her four children, and what do I do and where do I go? Or a woman who had been date raped, or these are the calls that they get every single day. Or a woman, especially back then, this is in the 80s, workplace harassment. Sexual harassment in the workplace was a big thing. I mean, in the 1980s, women were only making something like 73 cents to a dollar to men. It was even from then till now, there was a huge disparity in terms of the economic and social inequality between men and women.
Were you haunted by those calls? I mean, did you learn to listen as a phone counselor maybe a better listener?
You know, I did, and I was, but I was more excited about it. I was fascinated with this whole process. Like you said, I was on my way to law school. That's what I thought my entire life would be. I feel like that in Haiti, too, with my work in Haiti, and people say it must be so depressing, it must be so difficult. For me, it's exciting, it's fascinating. A lot of people have painful stories, but what I love about working with women, there's always such resilience and humor and compassion, and we have such connections, all of the women throughout the world, I find.
Well, I know you were involved in Haiti before the earthquake struck, but after the earthquake struck, you were down there within, what, a matter of a week or so?
Yes. I started working in Haiti about 7 years ago. Director Paul Haggis, from the movie Crash, he took friends of ours, all of us, to Haiti to visit Father Rick Frechette for Artists for Peace and Justice. If you go to the site Artists for Peace and Justice, you'll find out about this amazing Catholic priest who's a doctor who does extraordinary work. And I just fell in love. The minute my foot hit the ground, I knew I was supposed to be there. I knew it was my place. And I'd been working with women activists all over the world for the last 20 years, from Darfur to the Congo. And I had met women from Haiti in my activism in D.C. And so after the earthquake, 6 days later, Sean Penn and I, Paul Haggis, and some friends, we took a plane down to Haiti with medical supplies that we ran to the hospital to Father Rick's. We found an IDP camp filled with 50,000 people, and we started working at this camp. And within 2 weeks, the women from the camp came to me. They were very well organized, these young women. They all had green T-shirts on with the name of their organization 2 weeks after the earthquake. and they had copybooks filled with every single woman in the camp and what was wrong with her. And they said, please help us. This is what's wrong with these women. So within a day, we put up a tent. Within 2 days, we were seeing 100 people a day, 100 mm-hmm. women a day.
Did you have doctors, medical staff?
We had people volunteering, doctors and midwives and nurses from the camp. So within 2 weeks, these women were running the entire clinic. So we did this with $5,000 that a friend gave us. And when I went to larger organizations, who one of them got $432 million after the earthquake, and said, here, this is what we need to do. You only need $5,000. We can start these in other camps. I heard the same thing. Well, you have to write a proposal, and then we're not sure, and it's going to take a while, and it's not really an established organization. And so my Haitian activist friends and I, some U.S. friends who were part of that, just said, we started We Advance because we were pissed off. We were pissed off at that bureaucracy, because what we know, especially in developing countries, that it's women in those countries who know what their communities need. It's women who are already doing the work. And so the women's groups, the 350 women's groups throughout the country that I know and have worked with, they weren't getting any funding. They had no voice at the table in terms of where the money was going.
And would you say that the work that you were involved in shortly after the earthquake, that then continues? And the reason I ask that, I'm looking at a headline, this goes back a couple of months, from the New York Times, Rebuilding in Haiti Lags After Billions in Post-Quake Aid. And I think the idea is that, you know, here's this world community coming together, pouring billions of dollars into this very poor country with very little to show for it.
Well, I'll tell you this, I was just there a couple of months ago, and just speaking to a dear friend of mine who said, you can't believe what Carrefour looks like. Carrefour is this horrible, trafficy slum area that you have to drive through to get almost anywhere. It'll take you 2 hours to get two blocks.
Wow.
The roads have completely been redone. There have been overpasses made in Del Mar. Something that used to take you 2 hours will now take you 15 minutes. The plumbing and the water supply has been done all throughout the that area. So there are some great things happening when we look at the infrastructure of Haiti that I've never seen before. There's also a new district in the north called Caracal, which is an industrial park. Just a few months ago, President Clinton, Secretary Clinton, Dennis O'Brien, there was a whole group of us went up to inaugurate this site, which is for manufacturing in the Western Hemisphere, because it is such an incredible place to manufacture in terms of human capital, in terms of access, in terms of tax breaks. But this is so beautiful, these factories and the houses that they build for the people, and it's based in the community and on the community. So there are a lot of great things happening in Haiti. I'm not saying that everything's perfect, right. Certainly not.
But you said you were pissed off because you felt, I mean, and I think it's, this may sound more critical than I intend it to be, which is that there's a crisis. I think many well-intentioned people come in, but it seems that dealing with a crisis and helping a community always takes so much longer than we anticipate that it should.
I think that it takes longer than we anticipate that it should because of the bureaucracy. I don't think it has to. There are a lot of people in that country, and in many countries, but I'm just going to speak about Haiti specifically, that live there, that are already doing astounding work, that already know their communities and what they need. So when we fly in, you know, a week after the earthquake, and we see pallets and pallets, hundreds and thousands of tons of medicines and supplies with names that we know mapped across them, and know that they don't know who to give them to. Mm-hmm. They don't know what the channels are because they don't know people on the ground, really. You know, I think it's the bureaucracy part. I think it can be very efficient. Like, you look at my friend Sean Penn's organization, JPHRO, to see what he built from the first day of not knowing but asking the people what they wanted and what he's done with what he had is pretty phenomenal. And, you know, also women's groups that I know on the ground, like ProDev, mm-hmm. and the schools that Maryse Kadar, who's from Haiti, that she started immediately after the earthquake.
Are you also working to try to get women into government, I mean, into positions of power so they can make some of these decisions?
Yes, we actually, right after the earthquake, we shot the women's media campaign to elect Haitian women. You can see it online if you go to weadvance.org. It's under our gallery. And it's my co-founder, Barbara Guillaume. She's an activist and a singer and a songwriter. And we met with all of these women who are running for Congress, and we said, you know, what's the theme? Why should you elect women in Haiti? And they came up with this term, which is potomitan. It means, in Haiti, the center pillar of the household. So femmes se potomitan means women are the pillars of our house. And the whole idea, you'll see the media campaign says, if women can run our families, we can run our country. Mm. Elect women. So all of these women showed up to do this amazing video. Five women were elected. One of them, very sadly, died in a car accident about a year later. And still, there's this real push for women in government.
What did you fall in love with? As you said, the moment you landed in Haiti 7 years ago, touched your foot to the ground, you felt this chemistry or connection.
Well, two things. One, when I was 18 years old, I read Out of Africa, and I knew I would live in Africa. I knew I was supposed to go there. And as soon as I got a chance, as soon as I made money in my 20s, I went. I have a tattoo of Africa on my body. I was just obsessed with it. So I've been to Africa quite a bit and worked with women in Darfur and the Congo and Rwanda. And then I landed in Haiti, and I thought I was in Africa. Huh. And my friends there say it's the furthest point west of Africa. That's what it is in the feeling. But more than that, people say in Haiti you are taken by a spirit. You're taken by a spirit. In the voodoo culture, there's different spirits. Like we have different saints, right, in our Catholic tradition. And one of them is Erzule. And she is, there's two representations of her, but one representation of her is of the strong mother, of compassion, of the caretaker, of the protector of women. So the symbol you see for We Advance is the symbol for Erzule. Mm. So my friends like to say that I got taken by Erzule when my feet touched the ground.
Haunted ever since. Mm. We're almost up in a break here, but you had a piece recently, actually in the Huffington Post, about Darfur, and the headline was "The Badass Women of Darfur."
Yep, and they are badass.
In what way?
Considering what my friend, like Nima Damati, who I've quoted in there.
A quiet badass.
Considering what they have been through in the last even 20 years, even more than 20 years, honestly. What they have seen their families go through, what they have gone through personally, and how they continue to motivate people and inspire people and very slowly navigate the system to make changes, even outside the country, to make changes inside the country, is pretty extraordinary.
And that's Maria Bello, our guest today on Radio Time. She's actually in Philadelphia to receive the Myra Bradwell Award from the Women's Law Project. She worked there as an intern a number of years ago. She's had a long career as an actor, and she also has been a very ardent activist and advocate for women's rights. She's been doing a lot of work in Haiti. We're talking about that work. We'll be talking about her acting and also growing up in the Philadelphia area. Stay with us. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you living with relentless pain? St. Mary offers a new way to help. The Rapid Recovery Program for knee and hip replacements, designed to promote faster recovery, with patients walking just hours after surgery. St. Mary offers custom fit joints to help promote a pain-free life. Details at stmaryhealthcare.org/joints. St. Mary Medical Center in Langhorne, supporting WHYY. It's your health. Expect more.
Let me take these few seconds to thank the many listeners who expressed support of our program services during HYY's recent campaign. You continue to come through at a time of further declines in traditional sources of revenue. The result? Well, it matters tremendously. I'm Bill Morazzo, WHYY's president, and thanks to you, we're growing our investments in program services, and they're designed to help you stay engaged in your community. You count on us, and we count on you. Thank you.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Huey Lewis and the News created a signature sound in the 80s. It was modern music with a classic rock and roll flavor.
Kind of a technological cake, with the icing being real old school R&B voices and saxophones and stuff.
Huey Lewis talks about his landmark album Sports and that time he stowed away on an airplane to London on the next Bullseye from NPR.
tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Maria Bello. She's an activist and an advocate and an actor. Actor? You say actor, right?
Yes, actor.
Okay. I wasn't sure if it was the actor-actress thing. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I know your organization does a lot of work in Cité Soleil, which I guess is a part of Port-au-Prince, often described as a very dangerous part of that city. Has that been your experience?
It's the poorest slum in the Western Hemisphere and the most dangerous part of the Western Hemisphere, as people say.
Statistically speaking,
when I first got to Haiti, I went with Father Rick Frechette, and it was getting dark, and we were in an open-air truck, and he's so beloved there, people running after our truck saying, mi padre, and we just saw the kids he works with and the families and talking, but I'm talking about there's sewers where the kids play and where they wash their dishes, you know, where they defecate in the same thing with no clothes on, with malnutrition, that you can't even call their houses houses. They're basically cardboard boxes. And so I was brought into that space feeling like there's no fear. Right. A lot of people find fear around poverty when people are poor because they think people do desperate things, and that's true to a certain extent. But I think if you look at human beings as human beings, mm-hmm. I believe most people have very good hearts. So when I've been there in Cité Soleil, if someone has a piece of bread, they cut it into 10 pieces and offer you a piece. Mm. So we started our center of operations in Cité Soleil because here all this money was coming in for after the earthquake. But we said, oh my God, what about this part of town that no one is ever in? Big organizations will not work in our part of town for insurance reasons, because they can't get insured because it's too dangerous. So we said, well, okay, so we'll work there. So we started our center of operations, a small clinic and education center there, and we hired people from the neighborhood who happened to be, you know, connected to the gangs and the things in the neighborhood, because everybody is, but really good folks. And they have kept this clinic safe for 2.5 years. They will not let anyone come onto these grounds. We only had one incident. There was one guy, he was on drugs or something. He came on with a gun, and it was maternal health day. And you should have seen 200 women, pregnant women, run him off the property, screaming at him, get out of here! So I think that they've gotten used to us, and because we've become a part of the community, and we said from the very beginning, sorry, we don't pay people off. That's what we learned. Like, don't ever do it. You know, in the beginning, we got like, no, you got it. And we're like, yeah, no. Or we'll see anybody you want us to see. We'll see your family. We'll see your kids. But that's it. So I'm happy to say that we're very well integrated in the community.
You had mentioned Darfur and some of the work that you've done there. And I often think that, you know, you listen to the news and it just feels as if there is one crisis after another. Now we hear about refugee camps of people fleeing in Syria. Ugh. Is it hard to sort of sustain the kind of effort, of course, knowing how great the need is in other parts of the world?
It is, for sure. You know, I really, really struggle with that. That's why one of the reasons we started We Advance University, a website that'll go live in about a month. We started this website in order to Oprah-tize countries.
Oprah-tize. Like Oprah Winfrey-tize.
Right, yeah. Because here we are, when we were in the 80s, you know, things going on in and around my family with addictions and abuse and mental illness, but no one ever talked about this. Suddenly this woman gets on the air, you feel comfortable, it's entertaining, she starts to speak. So my co-founder, Barbara Guillaume, she really is the Oprah of Haiti. So we created a website where women can access information so that they'll know, okay, if I get raped, there is a lawyer right up the street in the next village who will fill out my rape report. No one's ever had this before in Haiti. And also, if I'm having a problem breastfeeding, they come to the center, they can push on that video, and it's Barbara interviewing a nurse from Partners in Health saying, so what do I do exactly if I'm having problems breastfeeding my kid? Who teaches you? So there's, you know, hundreds of video resources that women can come and to educate themselves.
You're telling us about good news from Haiti. We don't often get to hear that.
It is good news. But it's also good news for the rest of the world. Like Darfur, mm-hmm. Nemat and the women said when I spoke at their conference, immediately, we want to do that in our country. It's a very inexpensive model to educate a lot of people.
You mentioned Oprah Winfrey, and I'm looking at something in Huffington Post where you were asked about, I guess, her influence on you, and you said, as a child, so much was going on in my near and extended family, a lot of stuff that I could not comprehend, and no one ever spoke about alcoholism and drug addiction, mental illness, abuse, and then suddenly there was this beautiful woman, Oprah, on TV.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That was true for you as well?
Oh, that was completely true for me. And you know, I can't believe all these years I've never met her still. And I'm looking forward to meeting her one day.
But the idea is, and I don't think your family's unusual. I don't know much about it, but I think most families have some degree of these problems.
I do too. And I think it's especially with this younger generation, kids are more apt to talk about it now. It's okay. It's not these dirty little secrets all the time. And thank God for that.
But were you a kid that noticed things but just felt like you couldn't talk about it or you didn't know how to talk about it or it just wasn't a subject that could be talked about?
For sure, but I feel like that's made me who I am, and part of my activism and speaking out is because of all of the experiences I had in my life and everything that I went through. But certainly as a kid, you see everything as a kid, and you don't understand and... You know, that's why with my own son, I have a 12-year-old son, I try to talk with him about all of it, you know, talk about it as much as I can. Yesterday's talk was funny because I know Larry Flint, and I was with him and his wife the other night, and I was trying to explain to Jackson who Larry Flint was, and he was like, "Mom, I think I'm a little too young to talk about this right now." Because I said, "Oh, do your friends, do you talk about pornography yet?" He was like, "Mom, really?" So some things maybe not talk about.
Fair enough. You grew up in Norristown.
I did.
That's where your family is from.
Uh-huh.
You went to Catholic school.
I did. A good Catholic school girl.
A good Catholic. And were you a good Catholic school girl?
I went to Archbishop Carroll and then to Villanova University. Yeah. I was good in my own way, but, you know, in my own way, a bit of a revolutionary. I found, it was my birthday last month, and I found all these journals and letters from when I was a kid, from when I was 15 years old. And one of them was to an old boyfriend, and it said, you know, "You have to respect my opinion. If I feel like speaking out at the against sexism in the Catholic Church, I should be able to do that." And I'm like 18 years old, so definitely.
Yeah. I also read you were a varsity cheerleader. Is that true?
I was for 2 years. For Carroll, for football.
For football.
And my brother was a football player.
Wow. So you can do that jump, that thing where you jump and...
Yeah, there's only one cheer I remember.
What was that?
It goes, "First and 10, do it again, touchdown, touchdown." I do it sometimes.
And you went on to Villanova with the idea of going to law school and being, as you said, this advocate for women.
That's right. And I was editing a book for my mentor, my professor, Father Ray Jackson, who's my son's namesake. Yep. And I was... devastated when I started taking this acting class, because I realized that's what I was supposed to do. And I went to Father and said, "I don't know what to do. I feel like I'm supposed to be in service of the world, and this is such a selfish profession." And he said, "Maria, you serve best by doing the thing you love most." And that has always, always stuck with me. And if I could tell kids anything, I tell them that. How about that? Just that.
And why was he your mentor, Father Ray Jackson?
A friend, when I was going through my stuff, saw a picture of him the other day. She said, "He looks so fun." Number one, I said, he was fun. He had a sense of humor. I don't really get a kick out of earnest people. I don't really get a kick out of people who think that they know it all and they're very serious about their particular issue. I get bored. I like people who are... He was such a compassionate man, such a brilliant man. Understood all aspects of liberation theology, sexism, racism, whatever it was in the world, and still had such a life and a sense of humor about it, and compassion and connection.
Where is he today?
Oh, he passed away, sorry to say.
Oh, but you named his son after. Your son after him.
Yes. Jackson Blue, my son's name is.
And did Father Ray Jackson know that you did that?
No, but I know he knows, because I know he's right on my shoulder every single day. Every single day I'm doing this work, I know he's here on my shoulder. I have a picture of him from the pulpit winking. And I look at that picture and I go, okay, I'm not alone. Thank you.
And that's Maria Bello, our guest today on Radio Times. She is an actor. She's an activist. She's getting an award today from the Women's Law Project. Co-founded an organization called We Advance after the 2010 Haiti earthquake. We were talking a bit about that, and I do want to talk about your acting career. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So I guess you took an acting class. Was it at Villanova?
It was at Villanova, It was mostly because I had a crush on this boy who was taking the class, and someone said I could take it as an elective. But, you know, I grew up in a family. We didn't know you could be an actor for a living. Really had no idea. And I did. I took this class, and I just knew in that moment.
Really?
That's what I was supposed to do. So instead of going to law school, I went to New York City with two trash bags filled with clothes and $300 and arrived there on New Year's Day, and I read that journal the other day, too, my first day arriving there. Terrified, but excited. I knew something was going to happen.
And again, I mean, there's a theme here. You land in Haiti, you know you're supposed to be there. You try an acting class, you know you're supposed to be an actor.
Well, my mom has always taught us that about signs, you know, that there's a higher power looking out for us, leading the way. And if we only keep our eyes open and look for those signs, mm-hmm. we'll be led on the right path.
So what was it? I mean, was it just this... It being somebody else, the experience of acting, of just sort of taking yourself out of yourself?
I don't think it was taking myself out of myself. Since I was a little kid, I think I started reading novels, my mom said, by the time I was 6 or 7.
Really?
And I was reading romance novels by the time I was 9 and 10, because I wanted to be like the girl on the pirate ship dressed like a guy, and then the captain falls in love with her. I love these action adventures. And I always would put myself as the character in the book and see myself as that. So I had such a big fantasy life. So when I got the opportunity to read the words of other people and be different characters mm-hmm. and yet to use all of my emotions and everything that I had experienced but use their words, it was so freeing for me.
Do you remember what that first, what monologue or first lines you had to learn?
Funny enough, it was a Bob Dylan song that I can't remember right now, but it was about disenfranchised people.
Wow.
And I remember I dressed up like a homeless woman, and I had to say these words to this song, like as a monologue about these disenfranchised people coming to the United States. And I was so, you know, passionate and moved by it. I knew it was my path.
And did your teacher know? I mean, did someone say? Did people say to you, Maria?
Again, another sign. The wonderful teacher that I had at the time, my first acting teacher, Helene White, actually called my parents to say, your daughter has a real gift at this.
Wow. And you had never done that before? You hadn't been in a high school play?
No.
Really?
We always put on plays when I was a kid. I was always Mary with Joseph and Mary story on Christmas. We were always putting on shows for our aunts and uncles when we all got together. But, you know, that was the thing back then, too. In my grade school, like you said, I was a cheerleader. In my grade school, we didn't have soccer back then. You know, girls didn't play soccer. And when my dad taught soccer, coached my brother's soccer team, he let me come practice for a couple days because he said, why can't she be on? And he got crap for that.
Really?
Yeah, because that was back then. But the same with, you know, funding of arts education. That's still the same. So here we are in a Catholic school. We didn't have plays, right? So just not something that I did.
So there you are with your two garbage bags arriving in New York. Big plans, big ideas. And how much time did you spend bartending or waiting or waitressing?
For about 7 years.
Really?
I moved from floor to floor and couch to couch and basement to basement. Went to school for about 5 years and did off-Broadway plays and opened a theater with my friends. And even though then I knew, I mean, I was so damn poor at one point, homeless, and my mom had to bring me up medicine when I was sick from Philadelphia. I knew it was romantic. I knew I would look back and say, this was such a romantic time in my life. I really, really enjoyed it.
And was there, I mean, obviously something happened. I mean, either you got a role or I read that you were in an Amstel Light commercial.
I was in an Amstel Light commercial. I walked up to a table and I went, Amstel Light, right? So I had a couple of commercials during that time. I did some wonderful plays, and then I went to Los Angeles to visit somebody I was dating when I was 27, I think, or 28, and the first day I got there, I met a casting director from Philadelphia. She said, read this for me, and I said, okay. I read it, and I got the job.
Wow. And what was the job?
It was a pilot for a show called 77 Sunset Strip, the remake of it.
Huh.
And a pilot means you just do one show, right? And so I did one show, and then I'm so happy and very lucky to say I never stopped working since then.
Really? And is that because people, and I have to say, looking over your career, you've had such a diversity of parts. I mean, you seem to be open to different kinds of roles.
I think that's right. I think people understood very early on that they couldn't just cast me as sort of the hot chick on the side. I just don't have the personality for it. I also think that I've never tried to look younger or not my age. So even when I started working, you know, at 30, that was kind of like old to be this. So I've never been an ingenue, so that wasn't the point. For me, it was about taking roles that were challenging and that were really fully fleshed out women, like all the women that I know in my life. So I felt very fortunate in that.
And it seems like you're still getting roles. You've got movies, one in July, Grown Ups 2. You've got in September, Prisoners. And then you've got a movie, Third Person. So I'm not sure how old you are, but it doesn't seem to have held you back.
Listen, I always say, you know, I think a lot of the reasons women in Hollywood complain that there's no roles for women over 40 is because they're trying to look 20. How about that? Don't try to look 20, because those roles are going to go to a 20-year-old. How about just look your age?
Yeah. So
I feel fortunate that I've gotten some great, great roles this year.
I read about a director saying about you, you know, it's 20 minutes of hair and makeup, and then she's on the set.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea is that you don't need to glam up for the cameras?
Yeah, no, and mostly that's not for any other reason other than it's hard for me to sit in one place for a long time.
I'm like, chasing you around with a rush?
Yeah, totally. And my grandmother, when I first became an actress, she said somebody was interviewing her, one of my first TV shows, and they said, did you ever think that your granddaughter would be an actor? And she goes, my granddaughter never even brushed her hair. No.
But do you, when you look at yourself, I mean, are you harsh or are you judgmental? I mean, women sometimes are so tough on themselves, and you live such a, you know, a public life.
I think we all are to a certain extent. But even guys I know now, right, who are getting older, not even getting older, even my son at this age of 12, I mean,
he's looking at himself and being critical or judgmental?
Well, yeah, you know, because the acne's starting and the girl thing and... Right? So I think as human beings, that's just sort of our nature. But I really, when it comes up for me, when I do have those feelings of being judgmental about, you know, my cellulite or whatever it is, or the lines on my lips from smoking, which is my own fault, P.S.
Yes.
And I look at it and I'm judgmental, then I think, okay, well, this is a life well lived. And my only job is to learn how to become more and more comfortable with that and who I am and who I'm becoming.
We're almost up in a break now. I know have you quit smoking? I know that...
No.
Oh, no. I mean, it's just too hard to stop. I mean, you're talking to someone who...
Who smokes.
Who has been a smoker.
But I am going to quit.
Well, let's take a very short break again. We'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Maria Bello. We're talking about growing up here in Philadelphia. Her family's from Norristown, as is she. And she's in Philadelphia to receive an award today from the Women's Law Project. This is the Myra Bradwell Award. And as we learned, she interned a number of years ago at the Women's Law Project. We've been talking about her career as an actor. And we're going to play some clips from some of her movies after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Richard A. Reif Heart Institute of Doylestown Hospital supports WHYY. When a heart attack strikes, cardiac specialists know it's survival of the fastest. At Doylestown, they've worked to streamline every step of the treatment process, striving for faster care, fewer complications, and the best possible outcomes. Located on West State Street in Doylestown, the Heart Institute is now easily accessible via the Route 202 expansion. Details at dh.org/heart.
The Office is ending its 9-season run next Thursday on NBC. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to interviews with stars of the show. Steve Carell, who played the clueless boss Michael Scott. Jenna Fischer, who plays Pam. And Rainn Wilson, who plays Dwight. We'll also hear from Ricky Gervais, who co-created and starred in the original BBC series The Office. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Suburban Boston moms are saying they gained a new palpable understanding of how their inner city counterparts live after the Boston bombing lockdown. Also, a mashup of Bugs and Humans, music made from the songs of the cicada. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with actor, activist, advocate Maria Bello, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We just picked a couple of scenes, or actually one scene from two of your movies, one The Cooler and the other The History of Violence. And The Cooler is this really, really wonderful story, and it's you and William H. Macy. You play this cocktail waitress, Natalie Belisario. He's this cooler, this sort of sad sack, bad luck guy, a guy named Bernie Lutz. And let me just play this scene and then we'll talk about it. And in this scene, our guest, Maria Bello, is playing Natalie Belisario, a cocktail waitress at a Las Vegas casino, meets this guy named Bernie Lutz, played by William H. Macy. And in this scene, Natalie and Bernie are at a diner and she's reviewing his astrological chart, explaining he's a slow starter when it comes to romance. Let's listen.
But I can tell by the look on your face that you think this is all a lot of BS.
No, I know what the outcome's gonna be.
There's not like one particular outcome. A lot of things come into the picture, like the planets, the moon.
The outcome won't change with me. It'll be all bad.
Oh my God. I have never met anyone who was so down on themselves.
Do you know what I do at the Shangri-La?
Hi, Esteran. You're a cooler. You turn winners into losers.
Do you know how I do that?
Listen, I know there's a lot of stuff that happens in casinos all the time.
I do it by being myself. People get next to me, their luck turns. It's always been that way.
Well, that sounds like a self-fulfilling prophecy to me. There's a whole chapter of that in my book.
I only got 6 more days. Well, really, almost 5. I'm leaving town.
Only 5 more days? Then we shouldn't waste any more time.
A scene from The Cooler. I really like that scene. I think it works as audio, but it's really fun to see the two of you together. There's such sort of sweetness and innocence, and she's seducing him, but in such a gentle, nice way.
Yeah, I just smile even when I hear that. I remember the exact moment that Bill and I were shooting it. I remember the love around this character and this movie that we shot in 23 days in Reno in this gross hotel that just had the time of our lives. As soon as I read that script, I read her voice. That voice came out of me, and it was very Philadelphia accent, by the way.
I heard a little bit of that, yeah.
And that was exactly how her voice came out, and I went into audition for it, and it was one of those things, too. I knew I was supposed to do that. And it was a year after I had my son. I thought I'd never work again, right? Because, you know, I'm a new mom, and am I going to work? My career's on hold. And I got that, and who knew that it would be this brilliant, beautiful, beautiful little film? But more than that, it was the experience itself that really put me on a whole new track in my career and who I am as a human being.
And it was directed by Wayne Kramer. And I have to say, there's a scene where you and William H. Macy, Bernie Lutz, are making love. And it's really a beautiful scene. And you can see your bodies. You can see the intimacy between these two characters as they're exploring each other. And it's such a lovely moment. And you're naked.
Well, do you know, even then, that was, how many years ago was that?
This is 2003. Yep.
Yeah, 10 years ago it came out. Even then, we had to go to the ratings board to try to get an R because I was naked. And that always made me so insane that you could put so much violence on. And these scenes, which were, they weren't, you know, graphic violent scenes against the women. These were important scenes in a movie. If you look at both scenes, because we really worked it out like this, there's two different sex scenes. In terms of their emotionally where you are with the story, it drives the story in such an important and huge way. So for me, I always said it's like having breakfast. In one scene, we have breakfast and you see our connection.
Right.
And the next scene, then we're in bed and you see it falling apart. And then, so I was proud of that. And I was proud of that I, you know, we both have had at that time, you know, kind of regular bodies. And there was no issue about it.
Well, I think after the first time Natalie and Bernie have sex, she says to him, "Don't worry, I've had worse."
She's a very honest girl.
She's a very honest girl. I was also reading that this is something that you did with the cast, which was to take pictures of people's butts and their faces, and then to play this game of trying to I guess match the rear end of the face.
No, that wasn't it.
We
had been naked so much on that set, Bill and I, that we had a party for the crew afterwards in this little Mexican restaurant in Reno, and we called it the Show Us Your Ass Party. And we set up these curtains, a little photo booth, and you had to come in before you got your drink, and you had to get a picture taken of your ass. And then we gave prizes for the best ass, the most artistic ass. The other our prizes were like toilet paper, underwear.
Right.
People design stuff on their asses. I don't know. And we have no idea where that book is. Someone in this country has the book of everybody's asses.
But was that, I mean, that was obviously a fun way to end a shoot, and also just acknowledging the fact that you've been sort of naked and intimate.
Yeah, but it felt naked and intimate with the whole with the whole crew. It didn't feel strange.
Are there certain things that you look for from a director? I mean, I realize every director is going to be different, but as an actor, something that you need from a director?
Yes. I work with directors who are like good fathers. By good fathers, I mean that they have really strong boundaries and let you play within those boundaries. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I was with my friend Oliver Stone the other day, who I did a great movie with called World Trade Center. And he's been one of my favorite directors to work with. Him and Cronenberg, Sean Q, Haggis, they're all very similar directors in that they respect everything that you're bringing. They know that your job as an actor, they don't hardly have to give you notes because they respect that you're going to make it better. They just trust their actor. And at the same time, in the context of the story, they'll help you to know and remember exactly where you are and what needs to happen. Hmm. You know, so you're sort of on the right track.
Do you do a lot of homework for when you're going to play a role?
Never.
Never. You just sort of draw on those instincts, those feelings?
I do, and a lot of people, you know, and I was taught that as well, you know, write the history of the character, write it never helped me. You know, and it helps a lot of people. For me, I feel like I have a million different experiences in me, a million different pieces of me. And for particular parts, I pull up some of those pieces and I use that with the words and with the experience and listening.
Well, it's funny you said that, and we were chit-chatting before going on the air during one of the breaks about, as a phone volunteer at the Women's Law Project, your job was to listen. And so much of acting is about listening, truly listening.
That's exactly right, to really, really take someone in. And I believe that what the Women's Law Project does is so vitally, vitally important, not only to what's going on here with women in Philadelphia, but all over the world. I mean, the work they've done. I just found this out. Did you know that Philadelphia has the largest population of impoverished people in a large city in the United States?
Yes.
That's devastating to me.
And hungry as well.
And hungry. And for four decades, about four decades, the Women's Law Project have been working with these women, with these disenfranchised women. What they've done for LGBT adoption rights, what they're doing to protect our health clinics and Roe v. Wade, I'm still continue to be inspired by them and very happy to say that I was one of their phone counselors.
And you are receiving an award today, the Myra Bradwell Award from the Women's Law Project. And again, Norristown native Maria Bello, our guest today on Radio Times. I do want to play another clip, and you mentioned David Cronenberg. This is his 2005, The History of Violence. Viggo Mortensen plays a guy named Tom Stahl. He's a small-town family man whose act of heroism actually brings back his violent past. You play his wife, Edie Stahl, and realize that your husband is not the man she thought he was. And in this scene, you confront him, and he's lying in a hospital bed. Let's listen.
I don't believe you. I can't, Stephanie, I can't believe this is happening. You didn't grow up in Portland. And you never talk about your adopted parents because you don't have any.
In our name, Jesus Christ, my name. Jack's name, Sarah's name, Stahl? Tom Stahl? Did you just make that up? Where did that name come from?
It was available.
Yeah. I guess I was available too.
And again, a scene, The History of Violence, an excellent film, a very intense film to watch, I'm sure, to play that role as well.
Again, it was so fun.
Was it?
I find the most intense films I've done have been the most fun to make. You wouldn't believe it, Cronenberg and Viggo, how funny they are, what great sense of humor they have. So we did have a great job, but a great time. But what I remember from this particular scene when I hear it is, when I got on set, I said to Cronenberg, like, I just want to vomit when I hear this. I want to vomit. You know, I want to run into the bathroom. Where's the bathroom? I want to vomit. And he goes like this, there's no bathroom. And I go, oh, okay. He goes, everyone stop. We got to build a bathroom right now.
So the dad, right?
They did. They built the bathroom. Right. They stopped for a few hours and built a bathroom.
And I have to say, right before that clip, we do hear you throwing up.
Right. And you saw me run into that little room. Yeah. Which is the bathroom.
And I know you've been asked about this a lot, but there is this scene on the stairs where you and your husband are having sex there.
Yeah.
And it's this sort of mix of sex and violence and rage, and it's all sort of there.
Yeah.
Again, tough to watch.
Yeah. It was really tough to watch. It was tough.
You were bruised, right?
Bruised. I had black and blue marks from my neck all the way down to my feet. Viggo, like his arm, his elbow was, you know, 2 inches bigger than it should have been, and his cheek was bit. But as we were doing it, we didn't even notice because it was so exciting, and mostly because of the way David was filming it. Because when we first rehearsed it, we didn't know how it was going to do or what it was going to be.
Right.
But what David didn't realize is that, or what we didn't realize is that the stairs didn't have any carpeting on them. Because we didn't know how the scene would go. But he started shooting it while we were rehearsing, and it was so good, so then we couldn't go back and put carpet on the stairs. So we were just bumping around, trying to get it done. But it was very intense, but a beautiful scene that I'm very proud of.
And when you mentioned looking for roles, I mean, it seems like you are attracted to these intense characters. I mean, and I guess because you really get to act, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think one of our gifts as actors that we get to give to the world is we get to feel things so deeply, have experiences so deeply that other people don't have to go there, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like that most people would never get in that circumstance, that ease in, for instance, to have that sort of rage, but people do have it underneath somewhere, just can't be expressed. So to have someone else express it for you is like, okay, I'm okay.
Do you go to a lot of movies yourself or watch a lot of movies yourself?
I watch a lot of PG-13 movies. I go to a lot of action movies because I have a 12-year-old.
A 12-year-old boy, right? So who I know is the love of your life.
He is the love of my life and funny. I mean, 12-year-olds are funny.
Yeah.
12-year-old boys.
I was Googling you yesterday, and I ran across a woman named Maria Rita Bello. She's a bodybuilder.
Really?
Yes.
Maria Rita Bello.
And so as I was, and I, you know, I was Googling you, and I found her as well.
I don't know her. Maybe we're related.
She's quite built. You do have a couple of movies coming out.
I do.
Including this summer, you have one coming out.
Yeah, one of the most fun ones, Grown Ups 2. If anyone's seen Grown Ups 1, I'm telling you this, it might even be funnier. Really. I mean, to be on a set with those guys, Adam Sandler, Chris Rock, David Spade, Selma Hayek, Kevin James, Maya Rudolph, I mean, it was just a laugh. It's like being at summer camp. So that comes out, I think, July 10th. Right. And then
Prisoners,
a very intense movie. Hugh Jackman and I play husband and wife. Viola Davis and Terrence Howard are our best friends, and Jake Gyllenhaal's a police officer. Our children go missing, and he's trying to find them.
Wow. Yeah. And who's that? Who's the director of that?
Denis Villeneuve, this incredible French-Canadian director who did a movie called Incendiaries.
And then you have another movie called Third Person?
And then another movie called Third Person, which my dear friend Paul Haggis directed and wrote. We filmed it in Rome this year, last year, which was fantastic, with Mila Kunis and James Franco.
So how do you manage your life? I mean, you've got this acting career, you've got Haiti, you've got all these other things, you've got your son.
Every morning I wake up and I say to myself, how do I manage my life today?
Like every other person I know.
Like every other person, especially parents, right? When you have like the kids, and then I have carpool in the morning, and then I have a meeting in the afternoon, and then I just moved houses 10 days ago, and, you know, trying to get to Haiti when I can and do movies. But I really try to just be exactly where I am. Mm. And that helps sometimes.
And that advice, we're almost out of time here, but that advice that you got from your mentor at Villanova about doing what you care about, has that proved to be true?
Oh, certainly. You serve best by doing the thing you love most. Because more and more, by the way, I like creating. I like writing. I love acting. And to be able to use all of that to be able to promote this other thing I love in the world, which is advocating for women's rights, is pretty extraordinary. I feel very blessed.
Well, Maria Bello, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, she's receiving an award this afternoon from the Women's Law Project. And a couple of years ago, she co-founded an organization called We Advance. That was after the 2010 Haiti earthquake. And as she told us, a couple of movies coming up in the next couple of months. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscow. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.